Beruchim Abayim, ladies. We continue our study in Parashat Shavua. Forgive me for last week, I was a little under the weather. And next week is also tentative because I might be out of town. How will you find out? I guess if you want to call Rico, he'll know, or we'll put a sign in the synagogue. But maybe give him a call on Tuesday or Wednesday. His number's on every tape, just to find out if I'm in Brooklyn or away. If I'm here, we'll have a class. Parashat Va'era. Parashat Va'era begins with God telling Moshe, go speak to Paro. And it's the beginning of the Makot. Go tell Paro, enough is enough. Send our people, let our people go, and if he doesn't acquiesce, there's going to be makot. But what was the catalyst that God decided now to tell Moshe go to Paro? What happened that all of a sudden God says now's the time? So if you remember last week's parasha at the end, when Moshe is told by God, go take the people out, go help the people, so Moshe comes on the scene. And since he comes on the scene, it gets worse. Paro makes the decrees much more difficult. Moshe was going to make things easier. And all of a sudden he gets there. Now Paro says, I'm not going to provide them with the cement. They have to go out in the fields and make their own cement, collect their own straw. So Moshe Rabbeinu tells God in last week's parasha, Vayomer Moshe Lashem. He tells God, Adonai, Lama hare'ota la'amazeh la'amazeh shalachtani. God, why have you done evil to this people? Why did you send me? Umeaz bati il Paro, from the time that I came to Paro, daber b'shmecha, to speak in your name, hera' la'am hazeh. You only did bad to the people. Ve'hetzal lo hetzal tat amecha, and you didn't save them. Moshe Rabbeinu, as if now he has a tremendous claim, and he speaks with very strong words. What kind of business is this, God? You told me I'm going to go save them. Not only didn't I save anybody, but you're doing bad, you're making it worse. So Moshe Rabbeinu is talking very strong. In truth, we should see the next pasuk. God tell Moshe, you're fired. What kind of talking is this over here? Chutzpah. I mean, is it valid? I don't care who you are, even Moshe Rabbeinu, to flare up like that and start talking to God. You're doing this to your people. You didn't save them. It's getting worse. It sounds, you'll forgive me for the expression, but a little like chutzpah. It's a very strong language that Moshe Rabbeinu is giving God. And what does God respond? As a matter of fact, the Gemara says the angels at that moment came to God and said, kill him. He can't talk to you like that. So you see there was a claim over here. But what does God tell the angels? Leave him alone. Leave him alone. He's not talking for himself. He's talking for the people. He's talking out of the kavod of the Jewish people. Leave him alone. And God tells Moshe a positive answer. Now you'll see what I'm going to do to Paro. As if after he saw Moshe react like that, he says, okay, beautiful. That's the good reaction I was waiting for. Now we're ready. What did God see in such a reaction of Moshe Rabbeinu? We talked last week in Seudah Shlishit about Moshe's trait of sharing in the burden of his people. Moshe Rabbeinu was a very compassionate man, a very sensitive man. And it wasn't that he was just a leader commissioned with a job to take people out. Their misery was his misery. And he commiserated with the Jewish people. And at this point, he reached the climax of his concern for the Jewish people. He wasn't working, Moshe. He had a good life. He had an easy life. But from the way he was talking, it's as if he was working. A slave talks like that. What kind of business? We're working too hard. You're not making things better. It's getting worse. We expect the slave to have that nervousness. We expect the slave who's working to have the low tolerance and to be frustrated and to flare up like that. We don't expect it from Moshe. Unless we say that Moshe was so in touch with the feelings of the Jewish people and he was so sensitive to their hardship that he felt as if it's happening to him. So then when God saw Moshe react like that, he said, I don't believe it. You're the quintessential leader. You're a leader that is complaining as if the suffering is happening to you. Your reaction is so in touch with the feelings of Am Yisrael as if you're one of them. Then God says, Atatere, now you're ready to be the leader. So God was waiting for Moshe to reach that level. So the angels are saying, kill him for the flare-up. God's saying, I compliment him for the flare-up. Show me a leader that gets so bothered by the situation that's not happening to him, that's happening to his people, that he's commiserating and even talking like they would talk. Now you ripened Moshe. You've reached a stage where you're ready to take the Jewish people out. But there was a claim against him. Because the Torah tells Moshe, God tells Moshe, I appeared to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. And now I'm appearing to you. So the rabbis all ask, what is God reminiscing? What does he have to rehash? I appeared to Abraham, I appeared to Yitzhak, I appeared to Yaakov, now I'm appearing to you. So the Mefashim explain, Rashi says it, that God told Moshe, what a shame we lost the great tzaddikim Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov. They didn't complain. When I told Abraham to leave his birthplace to a land that he doesn't know where he's going and he had hardships, he didn't open his mouth. He went, he did what he had to do. When Yitzhak was faced with troubles with Avimelech and I promised him blessings and he had problems in his life, he didn't say anything. Yaakov the same, they were loyal, they didn't question me. And you come along and say, what's going on? You sent me, I don't know what's happening. I reminisce over the righteous old timers, Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov's, that never questioned my ways, and you're questioning. So the rabbi called that Kemusar says, hold it. What happened to Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov was personal. So they weren't questioning because it was the personal life issues, and therefore they accepted whatever God does for them. But Moshe wasn't complaining for personal issues. Moshe was complaining for the people. Isn't that complimentary, like we just explained? There's a big difference between Abraham not complaining and Moshe, yes, complaining. Abraham's not complaining because that's my issue between me and God. I'm not going to say anything. What should I complain for? But Moshe is complaining because he's the ultimate leader. Isn't the leader supposed to beseech God for the problems of the people? So what does God mean and says, you're complaining, Moshe? He should tell him, Chazak Baruch, like we just explained. We're proud of you that you're complaining. But the explanation the rabbi said was like this. God had a claim in the words that Moshe Rabbeinu used. You have a right to commiserate. You have a right to demand help. But Moshe used the word. He said, since you sent me to Paro, hera la'am hazeh. You did bad to the people. That's the claim. Moshe Rabbeinu, you're supposed to know better. God doesn't do bad. Even though it looks bad, even though it feels bad, if there's one thing that our God is limited in, and he does not know how to do, is bad. He doesn't do bad. That's God's limitation. He only does good, and even the worst of situations and tragedies is good. So God's claim against Moshe is not that he complained, but the words that he used. The Hafetz Chaim gave the example, if somebody is forced to take medicine, and the medicine is very bitter, does the person say the medicine is bad? Of course not. The medicine is great. The medicine is phenomenal. The medicine is healing. Medicine is good. It might be bitter, but it's good. Certainly the slavery in Egypt was bitter, but it wasn't bad. So the claim that God has against Moshe, why do you use the term bad? And he was not the first to use that terminology. If you remember when Yaakov Avinu went to Paro, and Paro asks Yaakov Avinu, how old are you? And Yaakov Avinu says, I'm younger than I look. But I had a hard life. I had some bad years. God says, you had bad years. He said, I had Esav problems. I had Lavan problems. I had Yosef problems. I had some bad times. So God says, bad times. You had a bad life. I saved you from Esav. I saved you from Lavan. And I brought you back with Yosef. And you're complaining that they were bad? So God subtracted many years from Yaakov Avinu's life. Actually 33 years from his life. Because he called his years bad. But if you think about it, isn't Yaakov Avinu right? God comes along. I saved you from Esav. Don't bring me Esav to save me from him. God says, I saved you from Lavan. But who put me in Lavan? You put me in Lavan. God says, I reunited you with Yosef. But you're the one that took him away from me. So Yaakov Avinu technically has a right to say, I had some bad years. God comes along and says, but I saved you. Damn, you saved me, but you put me in it also. Don't hurt me to save me. But the explanation is, what God's telling Yaakov, they weren't bad even when they were happening. The fact that I've set you up against Esav, there was a purpose in that. That was to prepare the Jewish people in their confrontations with Esav, that just like you were able to overcome him, you set the genes for the future generations that they'll be able to overcome. Yosef going down to Egypt was very important. If Yosef didn't go down to Egypt, we would have went down to Egypt in chains, on a ball and chain. Instead, we went down with dignity. He was the king of Egypt. We had a friend in the palace. We had respect. So even when it was happening, it wasn't bad. And that's a very big musar, the rabbis tell us, and God rebuked both Yaakov and Moshe. You're allowed to say things are hard. You're allowed to say you're going through difficult times. You're allowed to say that life at some points are even bitter. But you're never allowed to say that it's bad. You're never allowed to say that God is dealing me bad hands now in life. That's forbidden to say. God is doing good. Kol ma da'avad rahmana le'tav avad. Everything is good. Even the bad is perceived. It's as if the Hafetz Chaim said, bitter medicine. The whole concept, the Torah continues. The Torah starts to tell us the names of the tribes. It says, "Ele Rashebet Abotam." These are the leaders of the people. It gives us the children of Reuven. These are Reuven's children. His oldest son was Hanoch, Palu, Hesron, Karmi. Next one, Shimon. Now we go to the next tribe. These are the names of the people from Shimon's family. Yemuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yachin, Sohad. Okay. Now we get to Levi, the third. Ve'ele Shemot ben Levi. Torah says, and these are the names of the children of Levi. When it came to Reuven's children, it said, these are the children of Reuven. These are the children of Shimon. When it came to Levi, these are the names of the children. As if to say, these are beauty names. The names are very special. What was so special about the names of the children of Levi? Let's read them. Levi had three children. Gereshon, Kehat, Merari. What's so special about those names? So the Shlach Gadol says an amazing thing. The only tribe that didn't work in Egypt was Levi. Levi was exempt from all work. It's an amazing thing that even Paro understood that the clergy of the Jewish people must be exempt from the hard labor that the rest of the Jews were involved in. Even Paro understands what does it mean to respect to the clergy. Shevet Levi were the rabbis. So they sat all day long in the kolel, they studied what they did, they were exempt. But look at the names that Levi called his children. The first son is called Gereshon. Gereshon comes from the word Ger. We're strangers in a foreign land. Levi, you're not a stranger. You're not being treated like a stranger at all. As a matter of fact, you're being treated as your host. You're getting to do whatever you want. You have rights, you have freedom. But Levi's trait was, again, commiserated. He didn't want to have a lack of sensitivity and say, just because I have it easy in Egypt, so I don't have to worry about my brothers. So he calls his first son, Gereshom, stranger. The second son is called Kehat. Kehat means in Hebrew, sour. As if to commiserate with the feelings that the Jewish people had. They were having a sour time. And Merari, Merari is obvious. Merari comes from the word Maror. As if he called his third son bitter. The Torah says, Ele Shemot ben Levi. Pay attention to the names of the children of Levi. Because each name over there shows the empathy that Levi had with the Jewish people. Ad kedekach, so much so that he even called them by their names. But there's another interesting fact that the Seforno points out. Seforno says, when it came to Reuven's family, it lists Reuven and his sons. When it comes to Shimon's family, it lists Shimon and his children. When it comes to Levi's family, it lists Levi, his children, and his grandchildren. It gives us second generation of Levi. So the Seforno asks the obvious question. Why, Reuven didn't have grandchildren? Or Shimon didn't have grandchildren? Only Levi had grandchildren? So he answers like this. He's, of course, Reuven had grandchildren, but they weren't men of stature. They were good, religious people, but they were regular, not enough to be mentioned in the Torah. Shimon the same. He was a great man, his children were men of stature, but his grandchildren, not enough to make the cut. But Levi, not only were his children men of stature, but his grandchildren the same were on this level. So the Seforno says, why? From where did the children of Levi become so great? So listen to the theory, he says. He says it was known that from all the tribes, Levi lived very long. Levi lived a long life. And he was able to spend time with his grandchildren. He says, and the effect that that had on the grandchildren, that they were able to spend time with their grandfather Levi, that made them different. It's an unbelievable hadush. You see what it does to a child. And sometimes we don't appreciate our parents enough, and certainly we don't appreciate our grandparents enough. What does it mean to have a grandfather and a grandmother? Because they were exposed to a generation that was above them, two generations, that already they were connected to an old world. I'm sure Levi, the son of Yaakov, imagine the stories he's able to share with his grandchildren about what it was to be living in Yaakov Abinu's house. What does it mean to have a mother Leah? What does it mean to have Rachel in the same house? What does it mean to be brought up with these great tzaddikim? Imagine the stories that Levi, the grandfather, is able to share with his grandchildren. He's connecting them to an old generation. And this is what made the difference. In yeshiva, it's the same thing. When we talk about the old-time rabbis, you can imagine the effect that they have on the student when we can have rabbis living in our generation that saw the Hafetz Chaim, or rabbis in our generation that saw Hachem Ezra Atiyah, the Rosh Yeshiva Purat Yosef, or had situations where their parents met the Ben Ish Chai. So you're connecting yourself with a generation before. So that's so important to be connected, not only to the people of our generation. We pride ourselves in being modern. We don't want to go back to the old generation. They didn't know anything. We want to go progressive. And the Torah is telling us on the contrary. The success of the grandchildren of Levi was because they had the nostalgia from their grandfather Levi that was able to connect them to an old world. Torah goes on to tell us about one of the children of Aharon. Torah tells us, actually we'll go a little before that. Torah tells us, Vayikach Amram et Yocheved Dodato. There was a fellow called Amram. He married his aunt, actually. Even though that's forbidden according to the Torah, but the Torah wasn't given yet. So they were able to have these leniencies. Amram marries Yocheved, his aunt, as a wife, and they have children. They have Aharon and Moshe. This, by the way, is a repetitive pasuk. I don't know if you noticed, last week it also talks about this marriage. Last week it says it a little differently. Last week it says, there was a fellow from Levi that married a lady from Levi. Generics, no names. There was an Ish that went and took Bat Levi. Over here it gives us the names. Amram, Yocheved. Why over there didn't you give me the names? Well, they didn't have names then? Well, they just got their names now. One parasha later, they started calling him Amram and Yocheved. Last week's parasha, you're giving me the story already. Tell me, there was a man called Avraham. He went, he took Yocheved, had children. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says an amazing Hiddush. Rav Moshe Feinstein says, last week, they had children. They got married, they had children. But a success of a parent is not to have children. Anybody can have children. Go look in the world today. You don't have to be a hacham, you don't have to be wise to have children in the world, to bring children in the world. That's the easy part. And therefore, just because they brought children in last week's parasha, you're nothing yet. So what? Your name is not even mentioned. You're still generic. In this week's parasha, where Moshe Rabbeinu already grew up, where Aharon already is a grown man, and we see the results of the chinuch of that house. You see Moshe, what he turned out to be. Where does he get that from? Must be from his parents. You see Aharon, how he turned out. Now already they're of age. Now the Torah says, now we'll mention the parents' name. Now the parents have value. Now the parents have worth. Now it's important for you to know. The husband's name is not Ish. He's no longer an Ish. He's Amram. The mother's name is no longer the daughter of Levi. She's Yocheved. They are successful because they raise their children in the proper way. So while we bless people that have children, Mabruk, good work. The good work is really not to be judged until much later on, as we see the final product. And then the parents, we should go, when parents have children, 20, 25, 30-year-old children, then we should go back to the parents and say, congratulations, Mazal Tov, you did good work. Now we see the chinuch that came out in your children, that it's fine. That's when the real accolades and the praise must come. Not at the time of birth, that's the easy part, must come much later on. Torah says further, Torah says further that it became the time to give the plagues. There's many questions asked regarding these plagues that God gave on the Egyptians. What was the reason? Simple reason we explain is to punish them. After all, what the Egyptians did to us for 210 years, they deserve some type of retribution. But if you think about it, if God wanted to make a retribution against the Egyptians, he didn't have to make it so elaborate. It took a year till all the plagues were delivered. God could have came in one blow, kill all the Egyptians overnight, and khalas. Now, we've seen that in history also. So what did he have to make such a long, drawn-out plagues? What benefit? So the rabbis really say, the truth of the matter is, the plagues were not for the Egyptians. The plagues were for us. We were unfortunately affected by a lot of the Egyptian culture and society, so God had to rehabilitate us. So when God wrote all these plagues, we got to know who God was. We got to see His omnipotence. We got to see the Almighty. We got to see how He has control and mastery over all creation. So it did for us. So one rabbi said, Magid Beduvna says, that's not fair. God wants to teach us a lesson. So he does it through the Egyptians? Because God wants to teach us something, you got to kill other people to teach us a lesson? So he gave a famous example. He said, there was once a lady, she had a baby, and she had a nurse. And the nurse, in those days, would actually nurse the baby. And then the child became sick. So they took the child to the doctor, and the doctor says, well, the child has to take this medicine. But there's a problem. The medicine is very bitter and very strong. There's no way the child could take it. So we're in a catch-22. He needs the medicine, but he can't take the medicine. So the doctor says, Is there, you have a nurse? So we have a nurse. Let the nurse take the medicine. The medicine will go into the milk. And then when she nurses, the kid will be healed. Oh, brilliant idea. They go to the nurse. The nurse says, what are you, crazy? You hide me as a nurse now. Now I'm going to start taking medicine for your kid. I'm not taking it. I'm not interested. But what do you mean? The kid's going to get sick. You're the nurse. You have to. I'm not doing it. We're taking it to the rabbi. Take me to the rabbi. They take it to the rabbi. The rabbi says, what are you talking about? You have to take it. So the nurse says, I have to take it? So let me ask you a question. Did this child eat from anybody else but you in his lifetime? He says, of course not. I'm the sole nurse. He says, that means the child must have gotten sick from you. So therefore, it's only befitting that the one that got the child sick is the one that's going to get the child better. You have to take the medicine. She couldn't answer anything. The same thing. The Jewish people, when we came down to Egypt, we were tzaddikim, we had emunah, we were fine, we were healthy. Who got us sick? The Egyptians. They corrupted us. Before we were healthy children, we had no qualms on God. We lived good. We had Yaakov, the tribes. So God says, yes, I have to teach the Jewish people a lesson. We have to rehabilitate them. But who's going to be the means that we rehabilitate them through? The Egyptians, because you got them sick in the first place. Therefore, the medicine had to come through Mitzrayim in order to trickle down to the Jewish people. The Makot themselves, when Moshe goes to Paro the first time, in this week's Perasha, Pasuk says like this. Pasuk writes, Vayas Moshe v'Aharon k'asher siva Hashem otam ken asu. They listened, they went, they did whatever God said, go to Paro. Umoshe ben Shemonim Shana ve'Aharon ben Shalosh Ushmonim Shana bedaberam el Paro. And you should know Moshe was 80 years old at the time he spoke to Paro, and Aharon was 83. So a lot of the rabbis, Rav Shimon Schwab in particular, he says, what is the Torah giving us this fact over here? You should know Moshe was 80 and Aharon was 83 when they came to Paro. I mean, it's a nice trivia. It's nice to know the numbers, but what's the significance? At this point, you're telling me how old they were? At the time that they went to Paro, you should know he was 80, he was 83. So Rav Shimon Schwab says something brilliant. He says, the Torah's not coming to tell you mere facts over here. The Torah's coming to tell you what Moshe and Aharon told Paro. As if they came in and said, you should know, I'm 80, and he's 83. What is Paro care? So they were saying like this, Paro, it doesn't pay for you to fight. There's no way you're going to win, and we'll prove it to you. Think for a second, Paro, Moshe tells him, I'm 80 years old today. Do you know what you did 80 years ago? 80 years ago, you made a decree. You made a decree that all the Jewish children must be thrown in the Nile. That was 80 years ago. And I'm here today. So you see, you tried to destroy us then. You tried to kill us. I'm still standing here. So don't start. It doesn't pay for you. And by the way, my brother, he's 83. The rabbis tell us, 3 years before that, Paro made another decree. Paro's decree was that the midwives had to kill the children at birth, God forbid. And Aharon was conceived that year, and that's why my mother called him Aharon, because Aharon comes from the word Hirayon, that he was conceived at the time. And it didn't work. So the fact that my brother's 83 shows you your first gezerah fell through, because he's still alive, he made it. And the second gezerah of Kol HaBen HaYelod, you blew it then, because I'm still... So therefore, give up now, put up the white flag. That was part of the dialogue. It wasn't just a fact. That's how Rav Shimon Schwab says. There's a important point that Rav Hirsch says. Samson Raphael Hirsch on the Perasha. He says a point like this. What was a greater miracle? The fact that God brought the plagues? Or is it that he took away the plagues? What's the bigger miracle? To bring a plague or to take it away? So Rav Samson Rufal Hurst says, the cessation of a plague is even more striking than the fact that God can bring the plague. What does he explain? He says like this. Where do you see mastery of God? Or in general, where do we see control of people? Control usually is seen if you're able to stop something. If you're able to stop something that's happening already, that shows mastery and control. For example, a scientist in the laboratory, once he creates something, it's finished. Now, once the gas is let out into the world, you can't undo it. You can't take it back. Once the element is out, that's it. There's no taking. So man can create. Man can produce. Man can do. But once nature is created, that's it. It happens. There's no way of stopping it. The greatness of God is that not only can he create, but when he wants to stop it, he can also stop it. So the Hartumim, if you notice, all these magicians of Pharaoh, all they were able to do at most was match the plague. Who wants them to match the plague? I need you to match the plague. They come, they make blood. So the Hartumim come along and say, we'll match, we'll make also blood. Take away the blood. Then you show me your Hakam. To bring more blood, the Jewish, Moshe brought frogs. What does the Egyptian Hartumim do? They also bring frogs. Azak Baruch, you need more frogs? If you're a real Chacham, you take away the frogs. And you see, the great control is that God is able to stop the nature. Sunrise and sunset. If it was just an act of nature, that's it. There's no controlling it. It's just going to happen until the end of time, sunrise, sunset. But since God created sunrise and sunset, when Yehoshua ben Nun was fighting a war one Friday afternoon, and he needed a few more hours to finish the war, Shabbat was coming. So what did he do? He turned to God and said, Hashem, I need a few hours. So God said, okay, well, tell the sun to stop. And he went like this, boom, the sun stopped for a couple of hours, they finished the war, then the sun set. The fact that sun rises and sun sets doesn't prove me anything. Maybe it's nature. Maybe Mother Nature, like we were taught for so many years. Mother Nature is apikorsut. Mother Nature is kafrut. We don't believe in such a thing. But the goyim try to make it as if Mother Nature, it's natural events. Sunrise, it's scientific. They could tell you tomorrow morning, sunrise will be exactly at 7:18. They can give you the sunrise in any longitude and latitude in any place in the world for the next 1,000 years. So you say it's scientific. It's not God. We could put an equation to it. When do you see, what's the proof that it's not scientific? If you could stop it. If you could stop the sun once, yeah, it's not science anymore. It's not natural. So the control is usually seen not to make things happen. The control is seen when you could stop it from happening. So it's very significant. The makot, the greatness really is not that they happened, is that God was able to take it back. It's in the middle of hailing. In the middle of the hail, Pharaoh says, I had enough, take it away. Moshe Rabbeinu stops it on a dime. The hail stopped in the middle of the air. The rabbis tell us in Gemara, that hail is still suspended in mid-air till today. When Mashiach comes, God's going to let the gravity take over, and the hail's going to come down under the Shaim also. So you see, the greatness was to take it away. So Rav Samuel Farrell says a big hadush. He says, maybe that's the difference between why Jews celebrate Shabbat as their day, and Goyim celebrate Sunday. The Goyim who look at the world more in a natural way, so they celebrate Sunday, that's the day where things started to happen. That's the day that things started to be created. So they're celebrating the day of creation. But to the Jews, we celebrate the day where we see the mastery of God. The day that you saw control was not on Sunday. The day you saw control was on Shabbat, when everything was being created and all of a sudden God said, stop! And everything stopped. That's where you see that Borei Olam is the master over everything. That he's not only to create things, but his creations, he's able to put them on pause and stop them for a certain amount of time. The natural forces are under the control of God. Torah tells us that one of the plagues was lice, kinim. Of course, it's a very annoying plague, to say the least. You could imagine children come home from yeshiva with a note that says there's a lice infestation in the school. It's because they found a few eggs in some children's hairs and we panic. Don't touch anybody, and we bathe them, and we put all types of shampoos and so on and so on. That's for a few eggs. Could you imagine what went on in Egypt with lice? The whole country is infested. But the Hiddush over here was that the Hartumim, the magicians of Paro, when it came to lice, they said, that's it, we're out. We can't do it. Blood, they copied. Frogs, they copied. Lice, they didn't even take a shot at it. So the rabbis all ask, why not? Why did they become handicapped when it came to the lice? So Rashi gives an explanation, which is, since lice are very small, so witchcraft and magicry and sorcery, they don't have the power to create things that are so minute. There has to be a certain size for them to work with. Things that are very minute, like lice, that's underneath their beneath their powers. That's one explanation. But there's another explanation said by the Hakamim, based on a story. The Gemara in Sanhedrin tells a story. One time there were some witches. You have to remember, in the olden days, it was a big problem in the Jewish people. Torah tells us that you're not allowed to give any mercy to a witch. Torah says you have to kill them. So there was a city in Ashkelon, and over there was 40 witches. And they were doing all their black magic and so on. So they came to the rabbis and they said, listen, you gotta kill them. You gotta get rid of them. So they said, how are we gonna get them? They're witches. We're gonna go there, they're gonna put a spell on us, and we're not gonna be able to get them. So the advice that they got was, you have to trick them. So what did they do? It was a rainy day. The rabbi brought 40 students. Each one was holding a bucket. And in the bucket, there was like a white sheet or a sheet in the bucket. And the rabbi walked into the witch school and said, ladies, it's raining outside today. I could make a magic trick and bring 40 rabbis in here right now from the rain that will not have a drop of water on them. I said, this is Hiddush, novelty. We want to see it. So what did they do, the rabbis? They went, they took the sheet out of the bucket, they put it on their heads, like ghosts, and they came into the room, and each rabbi grabbed a witch and lifted them off the floor. Once they lifted them off the floor, they lost their powers. And then they were able to take them to Betin and end up killing all 40 of them. So the rabbis learned from here that the source of witchcraft comes from the ground. That's why we're very careful. Anytime we touch our shoes, we wash our hands. Because the ground has a lot of tuma'ah. The ground has a lot of contamination. The ground is very dirty. There's a lot of spirits and demons, words that we don't have to know. Words that shouldn't scare anybody. In our society today, the greatest movies talk about these concepts over here, which is another subject, how perverted a society is that gets entertainment from such witchery and things like this. One thing our Torah talks about, it's the Egyptians. It's not certainly not a Jewish thing. In any event, when the witch is grounded on the floor, he receives powers. The problem with the lice was, the Torah tells us, all the dirt in Egypt turned into lice. So there was no place for the witches to stand. Anywhere they went, they were standing on lice. So they dug. They dug 6 feet, there was still lice. So therefore, they said, you took electricity away from us. You took the magnet away from us. There's no way we can stand to make the makkah. Therefore, they said, Etzba Elohim, this indeed is the finger of God. Lastly, when it comes to the plague of Barad, which was the hailstones that came crashing down
mixed with fire. So the Pasuk writes that after it came down and Paro also was still stubborn, Torah tells us like this.
Vayomer elav Moshe. Moshe tells Paro, I'm going to leave the city. I'm going to raise my hands to God. And the hail will stop. Moshe tells him, I have to go out of the city. Moshe couldn't pray in Egypt proper, because the city was filled with all Avodah Zarah. So he tells him, you have to give me a chance to get out of the city here, because I'm not allowed to pray in this city with all these pagans and all these different types of idolatry. So I'm going to leave the city, I'll turn to God, and the plague will stop.
He says, but I know. He says, I know that it's not going to work. I know you're not ready yet. I know you don't fear God yet. I know you didn't learn the message from this plague. I know you're telling me, please, I give up. It was white flag, surrender, take it away, I'll be a good boy. Moshe tells Paro, I doubt that you got the message yet. And then there's an interesting pasuk over here. The pasuk says, V'hapishta v'se'ora nukata. The Torah tells us that in Egypt, they had flax. Flax is like linen. So it says the linen, the flax, and the barley was destroyed. You can imagine that fields of barley, fields of flax, the hail comes down, ruins all their crop. V'ahita v'akusemet lo nuku. But the wheat and the corn was not attacked, was not touched. Why wasn't it touched? Because the wheat and the corn is a late crop. So it didn't come out yet. Had the plague been 2 weeks later, it would have gotten the wheat and the corn. So all the rabbis ask, what in the world is the Torah telling us? It's such a funny subject. Oh, but we should know, by the way, this attacked the flag. What do we care what it attacked? What didn't it? We're not farmers. We have to know exactly the cycle. Oh, you should know this only hit the flax, but the wheat is a late crop, and therefore it didn't get hit till later. What does it mean? So Rav Samson Farlhurst says, brilliant. He said, no, this is not, again, a fact. This is what Moshe was telling Paro. Moshe tells Paro, you know why you're still going to be stubborn? So I know your head already, Paro. I know what you're thinking. What you're thinking is like this. God made a mistake on this plague. Because if God really wanted to hit us, He would have delayed the plague 2 weeks to attack the major crop of Egypt. What's the major crop of Egypt? The corn and the wheat. But God got all flustered, and He brought the plague 2 weeks early, so He was only able to attack some flax and some barley. So I know you're thinking that, Paro. I know your mind. This was Moshe Rabbeinu explaining to Paro where the source of his stubbornness is going to be. He was saying, your excuse that you're going to make is, if God really knew what He was doing, He would have done it later. But from the fact that it only attacked the early crop, that shows God made a mistake. To show you how stubborn the Rishaim are. I mean, this is already the Dam, Sephardeya, Kinim, Arov, Debesh. I mean, you have already the 6th, 7th plague over here. And Paro's still already playing games. From here you see a very important lesson. It's the 7th plague. You see an important lesson about the psychology of human beings. People that don't want to see, people that are closed-minded, people that are not interested, no matter what you're going to tell them, no matter how many miracles you're going to show them, no matter how many proofs you're going to give them, certain people are not interested. And therefore, many times, we try to go to somebody and prove to them the Torah, the Pesukim, the Chidush, and you have a very sound argument, but they're not buying it. And you're wondering, how can it be? He's a smart person. And they refute you with very, very things that don't make any sense. And you're wondering, could you really believe what he's saying? I'm giving you proofs, I'm giving you everything, how can't you believe it? And the explanation is, they don't want to believe it. Because if they believe what you're telling them, they might have to change. You see, the argument is not what the Pasuk says. The argument is, I want to go to the beach. That's the argument. So you're not arguing with that. You think it's an argument, like the rabbi said, the Torah says, and therefore it's the wrong argument. They're interpreting everything you say. If I agree with that, I can't go to the movies anymore. If I agree with that, I can't go to Tadef restaurants anymore. If I agree with that, I have to dress modestly. So what do? Instead of saying, I hear your argument, you're making a lot of sense, but I'm not ready to accept the consequences of an argument. I love that person. Bring me a million of those people. It's an intellectually honest person. But most people don't have the courage to admit what the truth is, because they're not ready to accept the responsibility of what the truth bears. And the truth bears great responsibility. The Me'iri writes, the emet is very heavy. That's why few people carry it. And that's exactly Par'o. Par'o knows if he gives in, then already he has to stop worshipping the Nile, he has to stop worshipping himself, he has to subjugate himself to God. So it's not that Par'o doesn't understand what's going on. He doesn't want to understand what's going on. So you come along and say, Par'o's a fool. Well, he is a fool, but it was willingly. He did it on purpose. And that's a lesson to many people, as we said. There's no bigger fool than a person that blinds himself from the truth. At least be honest with yourself and say, I know the halakha says it's forbidden, but I'm not up to it yet. This person has great potential ahead of them. This person has a great road ahead of them. Because at least they know the truth. They know what the emet is. But to deny and say, nah, it's crazy, it's black hat, they're making it up. This already is a very... You're in the same league as Par'o, God forbid. And we know, unfortunately, until God had to bring all the plagues down on Egypt and decimate the city to finally get Par'o to twist his arm to say, okay, I accept. After everything was destroyed, but then already it was too late.